In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with writer Scott Russell Sanders. He is, by my count, the author of more than 20 books, collections of nonfiction, fiction, and also some writing for children. He teaches at Indiana University at Bloomington, where he is a distinguished professor in the Department of English and Creative Writing. He's won many awards for his work, and his writing has been published in many different sorts of places. His newest book is titled The Force of Spirit, and it's published by the Beacon Press. When you read what he has written, you, I think, will see that he is a writer that is has a place in a long line here in this country that goes back at least to Thoreau, and also includes other writers like Wendell Berry and Aldo Leopold, people who are interested in the relationship between nature and human beings, who write about sense of place, and who also are interested in the ways that the sacred can make itself known, sometimes in unexpected ways, in the details of daily life. I think that's what a lot of The Force of Spirit is about. He's talked with us before about his writing, and we're pleased that he could spend some more time with us. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. All we ask of callers is that you try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving along and make room for as many people as possible. Do remember, you're sharing the time and the space with others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or over in Indiana. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Sanders, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us again.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks very much.
We appreciate it. It seems that a lot of these essays grow out of the place in your life where you are, a place that more and more of us seem to find ourselves midlife.
Yes.
With dealing with things like children growing up and going off on their own, dealing with when you get to the point where the idea of the mortality of your parents is not something you grasp just on an intellectual level, but on an absolute gut level.
Yeah.
These things all seem to inform one way or another the essays in this book.
Well, actually, last week I turned 55, and a friend told me I had finally reached the back roads speed limit. and that was one kind of turning, but I'm very much aware in this book of transitions. My father died 18 years ago when I was in my 30s, and I was young enough, and I had very young children. I was young enough to feel somehow that my own mortality was a long way in the future, even though my father had died. My mother's still alive. My wife's father is still alive. But both of them are at a phase in their lives where they need a great deal of help and support from their children. So on the one hand, my wife and I are immersed in the responsibilities towards aging parents, as are many of our contemporaries. And on the other hand, our two children have grown up, gone to college, and both of them, during the course of the writing of this book, got married and have started households of their own. So my wife and I feel very much that we are living in between. We're living in between the generation ahead of us who are aging and who are giving up not only their power and their authority, but they're also giving up their lives. And on the other hand, on the other side of us are the young people who are just establishing their lives.
It seems to me that this is a time that it's almost impossible to prepare for, in the sense that one is at the point where you're still a child and you are a parent, and yet, because the children are adults and the parents are older, the nature of those relationships, it's completely different. And for that reason, I think it becomes really hard to figure out, well, Now, what is, you know, given the demographics, what is the nature of that relationship now?
You've put it very well, because the two changes that we have to go through, that is people of the age of my wife and me, that we have to go through, on the one hand, we have to give up being the parents of our children in the sense of hovering and making decisions about their lives, because they now have a kind of autonomy that, in fact, we have wanted for them since they were born. We have raised them to stand on their own feet, and lo and behold, they're standing on their own feet. And so we have to be willing to shift our way of being parents towards our children. And at the same time, we have to shift our way of being children toward our parents, because, in fact, we are taking more and more of the parental role towards our own parents. That is, we're handling their finances, we're making decisions for them, we're comforting them when they're in pain and when they're lonely. We're doing for them the kinds of things that they did for us when we were children, and the kinds of things which we hope, if we live to be that age, our own children will choose to do for us. Mm. But it does involve a lot of shifting in our sense of who we are and where we are in our lives. Mm.
I think, too, that for some people, depending on how much they're involved with their parents and how difficult it might be and what kind of care that they might need, that one might not have the luxury of the time to even think about that.
Yeah.
Do you feel that somehow it is something where you have been able to spend some time in reflection?
Yes, and I'm grateful for that. And I have a contrast between my two parents, because my father died quite suddenly of a heart attack. There was no forewarning. There was no dwindling sickness. There was no time for him or anyone else to prepare. So I just got a call one day from my mother, and she said that he had died quite suddenly when he was away from home. And in that case, I have continued to feel all these many years later a sense of incompletion, a sense of not being able to say a number of things that I wanted to say, and not being able to learn a number of things from my father I wanted to learn. So on the one hand, I have that sudden, abrupt death of one of my parents. On the other hand, my mother, who is still very active, I've thoroughly enjoyed her older age and have come to know her much better as an adult, really, than I did as a child. I've come to appreciate much more her qualities and her character. She's a woman who, in her 80s, teaches an aerobics class at the Senior Citizen Center and teaches ballroom dancing classes at a community center in town, and I have relished the opportunity to get to know her better. So although she's not in any sense dying, she's in fact in quite good health, she can't be that many years, certainly not decades, from her death, and I feel that I've had a chance to get to know her better and to better appreciate who she is and what she has meant in my life. With my wife's parents, her mother, we've had the two contrary examples. Her mother died 2 years ago of complications following on Alzheimer's. And by the time we realized that she had Alzheimer's disease, her mother had already begun to lose her memory, begun to lose much of her faculty of speech. And so the children and the widower were able to gradually let go of her as she withered away, but the woman herself, I don't think, Ruth's mother, my wife's mother, I don't think was able to come to terms with her own, with what was happening to her. And finally, my wife's father, who is suffering from congestive heart failure and who is the central subject of the title essay, The Force of Spirit, is a man whom I have also learned a great deal from, and I feel blessed that his dying has been slow enough that both my wife and I have been able to spend a lot of time with him and have many deep and important conversations with him.
Hmm. I think there, what that gets at, and maybe it is a question that one way or another you take up in many of these essays is the question of, well, to use the title, it's the question of the force of spirit and what exactly that is. What is it that animates us, that animates other living things, that makes things continue to go?
If you've been around a person actually and see him or her through death, from being alive until afterlife, the transition from life to death is so dramatic, it's so profound, that one realizes that what it is that animates you as you talk, I as I talk, and everybody who happens to be listening, what animates us, what keeps us moving, what keeps all of our parts working, to call it life is only to label a mystery. It remains an extraordinary mystery. And how mysterious it is not clear until you encounter its absence. So if you see the dead body of someone you have known well and someone you have loved, you feel this profound difference and you recognize how mysterious life is. I use the word spirit in the book in many different ways, in part to speak about this mystery that we call life, in part to speak about the energy that flows through not only human lives, but all life, and also the particular kind of energy that we encounter in people who have a kind of courage to live, who have a powerful will, who have a desire to do important things with their life. When you encounter that, again, one feels, or at least I feel, this sense of awe and wonder and deep mystery.
Our guest is Scott Russell Sanders. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of English and Creative Writing at Indiana University of Bloomington and has published several collections of essays. He's also written fiction. He's written some books for children. And his most recent collection of writing, the book that we're talking about here this morning, is titled The Force of Spirit, and it's published by Beacon Press and is out in bookstores if you'd like to look at it. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I was interested to look at your biography and learn that when you were in college, you studied both English and physics.
Yes.
And then apparently decided to, you got more and more interested, must have gotten more interested in writing, and then went on to do a PhD in English at Cambridge, and after that started teaching in Indiana, and you've been there since that time. I wonder what it was, do you think, that led you in the direction of being a writer and away from perhaps being a scientist?
Well, a number of factors. I should preface this by saying that I love science. I'm married to a scientist. My wife is a biochemist. My daughter is studying to get a PhD in biology, and I read popular science all of the time. So I didn't turn my back on science in any sense. I love science. But when I had to choose the path of study, I went into college absolutely obsessed with science and mathematics and certain that was where I was going to make my life. But the deeper I went into science, the harder it was for me to feel the connections between what I was learning and what I most cared about. Because what I most care about are the large-scale patterns in nature, the bonds of human community, the structures of families, storytelling. And none of these are really addressed by science, at least not in the kind of science I was studying. So part of the reason I was drawn away from physics to literature was because literature addressed the moral and historical and philosophical and religious issues that so deeply mattered to me. Part of the reason was that I was wrestling with personal questions about the meaning of life, about my own identity, about my relations with family. I was wrestling with questions that I began to explore through my own writing in journals, writing in poems, writing in short stories. And so it's natural when you're trying to write in those forms that you want to see what other people have done in them. So I was reading as much poetry and as much fiction and as much drama as I could get my hands on. And so it made sense for me to study that formally in literature courses. And I'll mention just one other reason for the turn away from physics to literature, and that had to do with the Vietnam War. I was deeply opposed to that war, and I was dismayed to see how the military priorities of the government were infiltrating scientific research. And when I found out that a great deal of the research funding that was going to physics was coming from the Pentagon for the development, for example, of lasers, hoping that they would turn into some kinds of weapons, or nuclear research also for weapons. When I found out that so much of the funding for physics was coming from the military, I felt that I simply could not spend my life pursuing research where I had to justify it according to military priorities. So that was an additional reason for turning away from physics to literature. Mm. And I think for me it was clearly the right choice.
Do I remember correctly that your father was somehow involved in the military or in weapons research?
You remember that he worked on a military base in Ohio. I wrote about it in my book called The Paradise of Bombs, which we talked about some years ago. Hmm. And in The Paradise of Bombs, I tell how we moved to this military base where bombs and artillery shells were manufactured. My father was, in fact, a civilian. He was not in the military, but he worked for the contractor, which happened to be the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, the civilian contractor that operated this munitions plant, and he worked for them. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a number of my formative years in childhood living inside that military base and absorbing both the wonder and the terror of that operation. And I'm sure that my own feelings of concern, anxiety about the military priorities that operate in our society, I'm sure that concern was planted in me in my childhood years in that arsenal in Ohio.
You write in one of the essays, you write, and I guess I should say that these issues of spirituality are found throughout this collection in many ways. And I'm thinking here of one in particular where you write about the fact that when you were 12, a grandmother visited and gave you a Bible.
Yes.
Which you said that you were determined to read from cover to cover, from start to finish.
Yes.
Which you did. And were, as probably any 12-year-old would be, perplexed by a lot of it, and probably it raised many more questions than it did provide answers. Then you talk also in that same essay about when the next time you read it all the way through was in starting in 1967, when you were in college, and were thinking about whether and how you were going to deal with this issue of Vietnam and possibility of service or going to jail or whatever. And I guess I'm interested in hearing some talk about this. You're wrestling with what that book is about, and this whole notion of is there something called God? What do we call it, him, her? What does that have to do with our daily lives? Because that's really what a lot of the force of spirit is about.
Exactly. I tell in the book about, as you say, about my encounters with the Bible, because it's a book that has been profoundly important to me, even though much of the time it's also been disturbing and bewildering as much as it has been illuminating. When my grandmother gave me my own copy of the Bible at age 12, I was deeply puzzled by a number of things. I was deeply puzzled by death and what death meant and why it is that every living thing should die. I was puzzled by the anger between my parents, who quarreled a great deal in those years, primarily because of my father's drinking. And I was puzzled by my own early sexual feelings, that is, the dawning of sexual desire in me, which was upsetting and bewildering, and for which I had been given no preparation by my family or my culture. And I knew that the Bible was a book that many people looked to for answers to the deep questions in life. So when my grandmother gave me my own copy, I did what I did with any book, which was to sit down and start with page one and read through till the end. And it took me over a year to read through till the end. I read a few pages every day. And needless to say, about two-thirds of it I didn't understand heads or tails of, because of the archaic language, because it was referring to things that were simply beyond my scope at the time. But I garnered enough from that reading to know that this was a book that I needed to return to, that I was going to learn from in various ways throughout my life. When I reread it front to back the next time, of course I had dipped into it in the meantime, but when I read it straight through the next time, it was to try to answer for myself the question of, am I a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War? Am I a conscientious objector? And if so, on what do I ground that? Why is it wrong to go across the sea and kill strangers, even though your country orders you to do so? Why did I believe that was wrong? And how could I justify that belief? And I returned to the Bible and read it very systematically in an effort to answer that question. Mm-hmm. By that time, that is my second reading from front to back, I was a senior in college and then beginning graduate school, and I knew a great deal more about biblical scholarship and biblical criticism, and I understood more about the historical context in which the Bible was assembled. So that many of the things that were so puzzling to me when I was 12 years old had become, at least, if not perfectly clear, at least much clearer to me by the time I was 20 and 21 and 22.
Do you...
Now when I return to the Bible, again, although I tend not to read from page one to the last page, I do return to the Bible both for the sake of its poetry and for some of its most powerful stories, and for the example of Jesus, which has been important to me in my life, and for insight into spiritual questions.
Forgive me for having interrupted you there just a moment ago. This may be a terrible sort of oversimplification of where you are, but I guess it in looking at the essays, it strikes me that in some respects you're a man who really wants to believe in God and believes in God, and at the same time is not so sure about religion.
Yes, I think that's a very fair account. I am convinced that there is a power at work in the universe that all religions point to, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, on and on and on. And it's a power that is given different names in different traditions. And I'm absolutely convinced of that. And the word God, like the word Allah and many other words for that power, those words are encrusted by all sorts of historical associations, some of them positive, some of them negative. So on the one hand, I feel certain of that power, and I feel it in myself, I see it in other people, I behold it in the natural world. On the other hand, I am distressed by a good deal of what institutional religion has done in its past and also what it is doing now in our society and elsewhere in the world. Because very often institutional religion has become a substitute for thought, for independent judgment, and for direct listening to that animating power that I call spirit. That is, if you feel that some book or some authority figure has all you need to know about the world, then you stop listening inwardly. You stop seeking the illumination that I think is available to all of us. Also, religions, when they become institutions, are like any other human institution. They're prone to error, they're prone to dogmatism, they get involved in territorial battles. They are too eager to condemn institutions that that frame religion in a different way. Everybody recognizes that many of the bloodiest conflicts going on around the world right now, and many of the bloodiest conflicts that have occurred in the human past, have been carried out in the name of religion. And that those battles, those crusades, those holy wars, those vendettas, seem to me to be a symptom of what goes wrong when spirituality gets ossified in the form of social institutions, and when people in authority assume that they have the truth and nothing but the truth about the ultimate questions of the universe. And I think anybody who believes that, anybody who believes that he or she is in possession of the ultimate truth, is deluded. And if they try to impose their delusions on others, they can be dangerous.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, talking with Scott Russell Sanders from Indiana University in Bloomington, where he's a distinguished professor in the Department of English and Creative Writing. He's the author of a number of books, collections of essays, works of fiction, works for children, and his most recent collection of writing is titled The Force of Spirits, published by the Beacon Press. We have someone to talk with. Others would be certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good, wherever you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Freeport, line 4. Hello?
Yes, you're referring there. I have two separate statements sort of to make, but you're referring there to the terrible occurrence of holy wars in religion, you know?
Yes.
Yes, well, you know, there is often a reason behind this kind of going on. When one group, like the Jews, come into Palestine, and the settled Palestinians there have their land taken from them, you know, anything can happen from that. Whatever you want to call it, holy war or whatever. This has been the result of an invasion, in effect, of Palestine by a European, American-oriented group. But also, you were a young man, fairly young, during the Vietnam era, right?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Well, you're much more fortunate than I was. I was thrown into jail by the local Republican establishment up here because of my forthright opposition to the Vietnam War. And you were fortunate that you escaped stuff like this because of your age.
Well, Professor Sanders, I don't know if you either want to comment on that or on you want to wade into Mideast politics.
Well, I don't want to wade into Mideast politics. If anybody had an answer to the tragic conflict there, that answer would long since have been embraced, I'm sure, by peace-loving people all over the world. It makes my heart ache to think about the turmoil and the suffering there on all sides by all parties, and not just now, but through such a long history. And I don't pretend to have any insight into that quagmire that much better informed people have not already articulated. As for the Vietnam War, again, I don't want to dwell on that, but I was, in fact, a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War and had to deal with a draft board. In this case, it was in Louisiana, that did not believe in conscientious objectors. That is, they simply would not grant that status. And so rather than deal with a petition and a hearing, which I had prepared for, they reclassified me to make it impossible for me to be drafted under any circumstances. So, in effect, they threw me away. They did not grant the conscientious objector petition, but on the other hand, they excluded me from the armed services. And that did not make me feel good. It made me feel bad. That is, I wanted to have my hearing before the draft board, and also I knew, of course, that if I didn't go to Vietnam, they found somebody else to go in my place. So there is no morally clean or simple way to avoid participation in war if your country has gone to war. At the same time, I think it's a vital part of our democracy that we have made it possible for people to take a moral position against warfare. There are not many countries on the planet that would allow that, and that is one of the symptoms, I think, of the greatness of American democracy, that we have embraced that.
I want to return to talk some more about writing. I was interested to learn in the book that the word, apparently, essay, was coined by a French writer to and means something like an experiment.
Yes, it was coined in the 16th century by Michel de Montaigne, and he derived it from a French word that means to make an effort or to make a trial in the sense of an experiment. And he meant by that that these pieces that he was writing, that he called essays, and he was the first one to use that term, these pieces that he was writing were efforts at making sense, efforts at understanding something that he didn't understand. So he wrote about deep subjects like the meaning of death. He also wrote about what you might think of as trivial subjects like the taste of food or the pleasure of riding in a coach or the pleasure of wearing socks. You know, he wrote about small things as well as big things and simple things as well as complicated things. For me, the art form, the essay as an art form, is satisfying because it allows me to address puzzles and confusions. I don't write about things because I understand them. I write about things because they move me deeply and they confuse me and bewilder me. When I was in grade school and even right through high school and college, I was taught that the purpose of writing is to neatly package up something that's already known and present it to the reader. And there's a place for that kind of writing. But for me, the essay is not at all that kind of writing. The essay is an exploration. It's a journey into murky territory, into dark waters, in an effort to bring light to an area of confusion or bewilderment. And that's the function it has played for me.
Mm-hmm. I think about this particular form, and I think we have to acknowledge the fact that all writing can be difficult, even though maybe for human beings storytelling is a natural impulse, that might come a little easier than the kind of reflective writing that you do and other people do. Having said all that, though, I'm a little curious, since you do teach writing, about how you find your students taking to this or not taking to this form, and whether, in fact, they find that it's difficult.
I think it is difficult. I think storytelling is easier. It does, as you say, come more naturally. And actually, I do tell a lot of stories in my essays. There's a lot of narrative in the essays. My students find storytelling much easier. They also find neutral reporting, research reporting, easier, because they can go out and gather the information, organize it into a logical argument, and then deliver the argument without in any way putting themselves on the line. And what I always ask students, even when they've given me a thoroughly researched, carefully argued paper, is I ask, well, what does all this have to do with you? Where do you stand in relationship to this issue or this argument? How do you feel about it? How does it affect your life? Because only when one asks those additional questions, I think, is there any likelihood that the writing is going to really take on energy and power. So it is difficult for college students and high school students, I think, to write the reflective essay. Perhaps in some degree it's a middle-aged or older person's form. It's not a lyrical form. It's not primarily a storytelling form. It's a reflective form. And teenagers and young adults and people even in their 20s are so busy establishing their lives, getting their education, perhaps getting married, perhaps starting a family, certainly starting jobs and careers. They're so busy doing all of that they don't have the time and maybe not even the impulse to reflect on who they are and where they are and why they're doing what they're doing. But by the time you're in your 30s and certainly in your 40s and 50s, that reflection becomes more and more a matter of urgency. And I feel fortunate that the conditions of my life have permitted me to do a lot of reflecting, and that writing has given me an outlet for expressing it.
We have several callers, and about 10 minutes left. We'll try to accommodate everyone. Charleston is next, line number 4. Hello?
Yes. Good program, Dave. I'm wondering if your guests would have any thoughts and reflections or essay tools that would confront the 21st century imperial capitalism and its effect upon humankind and where we are going. It appears, you know, as the system becomes more concentrated and the power of money is in fewer hands, and how that affects our daily lives. I mean, I have my own ideas about that, but I'm curious about your guest and if he would, or if he even addresses that, not necessarily as an economic question, but as one that addresses life and its effects upon the data. And it's been 200 years that we have had this assault upon humanity by capitalist interests. And now that it's reached its imperial stage, what is in front of us? I'll hang up and thank you.
All right.
Well, you ask, the caller asks a series of very difficult questions, most of which I'm not competent to answer, certainly not about economics. I share his concern about the effects of concentrating more and more power and more money in smaller and smaller groups of people and fewer hands. A lot of people make noise about worrying about big government, but implicitly, if they don't want big government, they're voting to be ruled by big corporations. And that alternative, frankly, is not appealing to me, because at least I get to vote, and I get to complain, and I get to petition, and I get to go have hearings with politicians. But I don't get to do that with the corporations. So the prospect of having not only the United States, but the whole planet ruled by corporations is not an appealing one to me. And I do write about that, not only in The Force of Spirit, but in my other books. Also, I think that the notion of that globalization is an unmitigated good also seems to me a falsehood. Certainly, many effects of globalization are welcome, but at the same time, culture, the diverse cultures of the planet are being bulldozed and flattened out and homogenized by the effects of globalization. Environmental laws are being overridden. Workers' rights are being overridden in the name of globalization. And I find all of those developments disturbing. And finally, and of course one could say many, many, many more things about this, these profoundly important questions, but finally I will say that one of the reasons I write the essay is because I am hungry as a reader for the effort of a personal voice that is trying to articulate a personal vision in the face of the homogenized committee structure, corporate images, and media models that we're all given. When I go to the bookstore, I look for books that give me a particular individual voice, that show me one human individual wrestling to make sense of things. Because otherwise, what my culture gives me is the products of large groups, of conglomerates, of associations, and of corporations. And those are, to my taste, those group products tend to be dehumanized.
Well, I think it's certainly true that I think one question that you ask in your writing over and over again is, what really matters in life? And that you in part answer that question by talking about things that last, long relationships with other people, making things, whether you're talking about a chair or an essay, that are useful and durable and beautiful, trying to pair down life to, you know, get the junk out of the way, pare off the extraneous things, and trying to get at what is the most important, what are the most important things?
I agree, David. I think those are my central concerns. Our culture tells us primarily that what matters is money and the things that money can buy. We hear that 24 hours a day, everywhere we turn. And while a certain minimum amount of money is obviously necessary to buy the minimum goods for life, beyond that minimum, money is irrelevant. And anyone who examines his or her own happiness and asks, what is it that has made you happy, what is it that has made you contented, will realize that it does not come from money, and it very rarely comes from the things that money buys. It comes from friendship, it comes from family, it comes from the beauty of nature, it comes from art, it comes from the satisfaction of a good tool or a well-made loaf of bread. It comes from the simplest shared experiences. And in our pursuit of our mad pursuit of money and our mad pursuit of consumerism, which is a kind of sickness, we abandon the values and the experiences that in fact give us the deepest satisfaction and the deepest happiness. So that not only are our lives impoverished by our very wealth, the planet is impoverished because we are devouring the planet to produce silly entertainments, vapid films and television programs, and mass manufactured products, many of which are junk. So it is the case that in my writing, I'm trying to articulate my own sense of what truly matters, and it has almost nothing to do with money. It has almost nothing to do with the political realm at all, or the economic realm. It has to do with community and family and nature.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller. This is Champagne. It's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A little bit ago, you were touching on some life experiences as a young adult, and I found myself sort of nodding in agreement. And it caused something in my brain to leap out at me, and that was a line from one of my favorite books. Well, actually, it's not one of my favorite books. It's sort of one of those throwaway books. But the book is called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. And the line, you know, I bought the book just for that title.
Yes.
But the line that leaps out at me, and it's the only thing I've underlined in the whole book, is a quotation from a fellow, I think, from the Reform Party convention in 1995, and it's on page 227, and it says, "It's what you learn after you know it all that counts." And I find it sort of particularly appropriate that I'm coming back to this the day before elections, because I think that no matter which party or which parties people plan to vote for tomorrow, there will be some shakedowns. We're all going to have to learn to sort of reevaluate our lives in the light of new political realities and so forth and so on. But every once in a while, I find that, you know, when I sort of am getting smug and I'm thinking, okay, I've got my act together and this, that, and the other thing, something comes along and it sort of slaps me down and says, ha-ha, smarty pants, you don't know it all, and here are some new realities you have to deal with. And I guess those are the kinds of things that you write about, and I find it so pleasurable.
Well, thank you. I think that we will have, however the election comes out, and I have very strong feelings, which I won't share, but I certainly have strong feelings about the election, and strong anxieties about the election. But however it comes out, you're perfectly right. We will have much to adjust to. But at the same time, I think the bigger reality that we as a people and we as a species have got to adjust to is the reality of the environmental limits of the planet. I am astounded at the complacency and smugness of my fellow Americans And assuming that we can sustain the kind of wasteful, greedy lifestyle that we have become accustomed to, that we can sustain that indefinitely into the future. And not only that, but that we can sell it to the rest of the planet so that everybody else can drive sport utility vehicles and build 6,000 square foot houses. I am astounded at that complacency and also at the refusal to recognize that there is a larger context within which our lives and all life operates, namely the context of the natural world. And while that issue has come up some in this election, if I were running for office, that would be the central issue. But obviously somebody who made it the central issue would never get beyond the local nominating group in front of so much, in the face of so much complacency, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm sorry to say that at this point we're going to have to stop, and my apologies, there are a couple of callers that we can't take. If you're interested in reading more from our guest, you certainly should look for his books. The most recent, the one we've talked about here this morning, is titled The Force of Spirit. It's published by the Beacon Press. Scott Sanders is a professor in the Department of English and Creative Writing at Indiana University in Bloomington. Scott, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure, David.